everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Here with you with the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and things to think about. Here's a new one for you, my friends. For women worried about fertility, egg bank is the new option. Yep. Here's a, this is a story from the New York Times where a woman named Grace Drake still hopes that someday she'll meet Mr. Wright and have a family the old-fashioned way. And what she's done, she took out some insurance. She froze her eggs. Yes, there is now a bank where you can freeze eggs. Egg freezing for a long, long time, like men have frozen their sperm. Now, this is just a fairly new science, just coming to New York as well. But here, think about it. Think about what we've done to Mother Nature. We are now harvesting eggs for freezing, putting them in a freeze, and then thawing them out whenever you want.
I guess that means that a woman can choose to have a baby when she's, 60 years old. Is that right, Armand?
Yeah.
Yeah, as long as you have the egg. You can extract an egg when you're 16 and then use that egg to get impregnated when you're 60.
And maybe you're waiting for the right guy to bring home the bacon so you could have the bacon with
the egg. Right, because let's not forget that that's what men are for.
Okay, so but the interesting thing here, Roberta, is we started this series on human sexuality talking about the need for a woman to be able to control her pregnancy.
Right.
140,000 years ago, for those of you who have been listening or not listening, there was this conundrum where women had to deal with this fact that if they got pregnant because of the new shapes of the human head, they could easily die if they weren't shaped properly, if they were too young. So they started saying, how do we control fertility?
So really, the sexual behavior became a behavior that became dependent on the woman's decision whether it was going to happen or not.
And here we are, 140,000 years later, freezing eggs. It's remarkable. We've gotten there today. Today we want to look at the main reason for sexuality. If the reason that sexuality even developed the way it did in humans, reproduction, to reproduce, which means to produce again, right? Reproduce. And what are we producing?
We are reproducing ourselves in a way, Armand, even though, of course, each one of us is unique and we're never going to be repeated. But think of what the DNA is. The DNA is our information system contained in every cell of the body, and it's the instructions, it's the manual that allows us to learn how to use a body on Earth for hopefully as long as possible and in the best way we can. So when we live with this DNA that we have in every cell, what we're living with is this manual, this information manual that was given to us by our ancestors. And so it contains the information they learned, because every time a new behavior becomes part of a species, that behavior is recorded in the DNA, so that information becomes already imprinted from the very beginning in the young of the species. But also as we live, Armand, everything we do and everything we learn bit by bit increases the amount of information that we pass on the DNA. And so the DNA we have in us is also what we give the children we have, so that they can use the same information to live on Earth.
So when we say DNA, we're talking about genetic encoding that is all part of our fertilization right at the beginning. Here's something interesting, friends. Did you ever hear of chimera? C-H-I-M-E-R-A, twins?
Well, in Italian, chimera means dream, illusion, some beautiful illusion.
Well, it turns out, Roberta, that every once in a while, a set of fraternal twin eggs merge into one embryo. So let's say you're meant to have twins, and one of the twins don't make it. This is still in the embryonic stage. This is at the egg. The DNA sometimes doesn't die with the twin that didn't make it. The DNA, the resulting person can have two sets of DNA. The story says that it's possible for a chimera, it's called, C-H-I-M-E-R-A, to have different sets of DNA in different body parts.
Hmm.
So now, you know, you may have your DNA and then the DNA of your supposed brother, which are not identical.
Amazing.
So you could have in your saliva one form of DNA and in your sperm another form of DNA. And this is amazing, going on in the same person. Now, why this is important is because for years, when talking about the different talents of some people are born, I believe, with more than one ability, more than one immune system, and we've seen this in multiple personality dysfunction. When you hear about multiple personality, I suspect we're talking about the chimeras. But because what they have is, you know, they'll have different immune systems. They'll be immune to chickenpox on one personality, and another personality they won't be immune. They'll have different eyesights. So it's beginning to get explained with this DNA research and what we're learning about.
Well, it's interesting because then it's possible that, as you were saying, one individual without knowing is living his or her life using a body that contains the information that would be necessary for more than one body to live. And I just wonder if on some level of psychic awareness that person knows, or if he or she has a sense that there's more than one in there. That would be fascinating. Because I guess there's no way to find out unless you test yourself. And who is going to go and ask a doctor, well, I'd like to be tested to see if I have the DNA of more than one person.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess all of it is fascinating because you carry information from your ancestors, and in one way, all of the human DNA contains very similar information for all of us.
You know, it's not so far-fetched that we could take any piece of skin, any part of us, and do a DNA printing. They could do it in a computer now. You just drop it on a lab, or you drop it on a piece of paper, you study it under a microscope, photograph it, and you can get a computer printout of your own DNA.
Hmm.
So, you know, imagine you could send pictures of your DNA to some of your friends. Here's my DNA. What's your DNA look like?
Mm-hmm.
So if we're getting to the point where we could freeze eggs, and we're getting to the point where we could now understand and get information from DNA, it might be useful to understand how does pregnancy actually take place?
Mm-hmm.
How does it happen? How does this thing happen? What happens when all of a sudden as every species, the mandate is put out there, make a baby, grow, keep moving. Today we're going to talk to you about the process of pregnation, of being pregnant, about insemination, and we're going to talk a lot about it because I think it's important to understand that there are many players. The people who don't have children are as important as the people who do have children in the society, although people without children very often feel shame for not having had children.
Sure. Well, because the instinct is so powerful, Armand. It has been imprinted in our brains and nervous systems for so long that the goal of life is to perpetuate life. Life wants to perpetuate itself through sexuality is how we do it. So the goal, I mean, when I see people who want a child and a couple who is not able to conceive, they are desperate because they run up against this instinct that says you must reproduce, you must. If not, your life is meaningless. But nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, what we're faced with today is a crisis from perhaps too much impregnation going on, and that is because maybe we went against some of the rhythms that would have been more natural. But Perhaps we'll talk about that later.
We're definitely going to get to that with lactation. Yeah, the whole idea.
But I think that the journey of the cells, what they have to do in order to join, is amazing.
Our work comes from a bunch of research we've been doing recently on human sexuality, some of the books of which we've mentioned in previous programs. But let me read something to you about this. This is kind of exciting. We described a little earlier, or we'll describe to you again, is that once there is a meeting of the sperm and the egg, the sperm sits first. As soon as it gets there, it sits in a pool. And it's in this pool kind of sitting there. We've watched them attempt to escape. Some of the sperm kind of jump away from this pool to get away from it. But then they migrate through the narrow channels of cervical mucus and eventually make their way to a rest area. Get this now. So you have this pool of sperm, and they travel, and then they get to this rest area in an oviduct. What is an oviduct, Roberta?
An oviduct is the duct, is the tube that goes from the ovary to the uterus, and that's the tube that the egg slides into to reach the uterus for fertilization.
Now, they rest, the sperm rest in this oviduct for as long as a day after the ejaculation. And at any one time, up to a few thousand may be resting and waiting. Now they're waiting, so it's a day later. I mean, you don't have it. You would imagine, oh, you have sex and you get pregnant that day. No, sometimes it could be up to a day later that you get pregnant. One by one, they wake up. These sperm, who are kind of resting in this area after having made it to this waiting area, and they swim further along this oviduct. The initial destination is a region in which, if an egg is present, fertilization can occur. So as the sperm approaches the fertilization zone, it changes its behavior. As it gets near around where fertilization is possible, its tail starts to beat more vigorously. And once it arrives, it often swims frantically, in circles, or figures of eight. The figure of eight is a common pattern for sperm. I think that's why we like it so much in ice skates.
You think so, Armand?
You know, that figure eight is kind of a fascinating. It means infinity also, you know?
Sure.
Okay, so then it's kind of gone there. You know, an interesting thing, once I heard an audio of this very process. Mm-hmm. Somebody had slipped a kind of a microphone.
It's amazing, because I saw a video of it.
The sound of sperm waiting in the oviduct to fertilize an egg has a sound that is identical to the sound of the ocean.
Like waves?
Waves. You know, on and off. And one imagines that this sound somehow enables the sperm to rest in that area. And yet here we humans later in life go to the ocean side and feel this enormous peace when we stand by the ocean listening to the waves.
Sure.
Yeah, I tell you, if there's a memory from back then. Okay, so let's just figure what happens next. Once they arrive, you know, they start frantically swimming. At any one time, the fertilization zone may contain anything from 1 to 2 up to 1,000 sperm, all looking for an egg, right? Now, and the egg may never come, usually it doesn't. After a while, they leave the zone one by one. As each leaves, its place is taken by a new, fresher arrival from the rest area. So, you know, sperm come up and they say, okay, let's go look for the egg. They swim up the oviduct. They don't find an egg. They kind of go off. They die. But new fresh ones come up, so it's not all at once. Now, here's where it really gets interesting. A short distance away from the end of each oviduct, suspended like a huge planet, is an ovary. Mm-hmm. See, here's his ovary kind of suspended. Tiny hairs on the inside of the oviduct create a current in the body fluid so that when an egg is released by an ovary, it's slowly wafted down the oviduct towards where you're saying, right?
Right.
Like a waiting hand, the finger-like projections funnel the egg into the tube. From here, the egg begins its five-day journey down towards the womb. So an egg takes 5 days to get to the womb.
Right.
To achieve fertilization, a sperm has to do more than simply encounter an egg. This is what I used to think. Oh, sperm meets egg, boom. Pregnant. So I was reading about this. It's remarkable what we go through.
Yes, it's not as easy as that. It's actually rather difficult for a sperm to reach its destination.
You know, when I think about the fact that many of us say, oh, God, I'm never going to get through this. Each one of us is one of 200 million sperm.
Mm-hmm.
Who have fought its way past its brothers and sisters to get to an egg.
I mean,
we're all survivors.
There is something very unlikely about being alive. I mean, it's not being alive is an oddity. It doesn't make sense.
One out of 200 million make it.
Yeah.
This is Armando Mill with Roberta Maria Atti. We're talking about human sexuality. We're now talking about the fertilization process. We've talked for four previous weeks.
About the courtship, and about mating, and about who decides
when and how
what
it happens. And
we
talked about biological imperatives that come from our ancestors from a long time ago, plus the human evolved mind and its effect and the effect of love. All of this we've kind of gotten to. But let's get back down to what the basics are, because I think it's important for many people to learn. When it happens, do you know that there are things about an attitude that could determine the sex of a child? There are things that I've learned that if a person is having a tremendously difficult time, a woman is having a great difficult time with her husband, if he hates her or if she hates him, it's hard for her, even if they have sex, to go get pregnant.
Yes, you know, I think one of the reasons for that may be that in order for the sperm to pass through this obstacle course, there's something that needs to happen, which is the vagina needs to secrete a mucus that alters the pH of the inside of the woman in such a way that the sperm can survive, because otherwise it's normally too acidic. And that happens if the woman is experiencing the sexual encounter as a pleasant one. If the woman does not like to have sex with this particular man, or in the case of rape, that mucus is not secreted, and therefore the internal pH of the vagina remains too acidic for the sperm.
Inhospitable.
Inhospitable, and so therefore conception is much more difficult.
We've said a lot.
Have we?
I hope people are kind of enjoying this. I think they are. From the feedback from you, you've kind of loved this stuff so far. Okay, so now let's go what happens to the sperm when it arrives at the fertilization zone. Right? Now, the egg is surrounded by three levels of defenses, and these are not your family.
And by the way, I think, Armand, we should say the egg is enormous compared to the sperm. The sperm is a tiny, tiny little thing. I think you could compare it the size, perhaps, of a mouse versus an elephant. I mean, there's that much difference in size. So when you see the egg, you see this gigantic thing just unmoving. It's just there, it seems like. And the sperm is moving very fast and whips his tail quickly and very agitated, very eager to pierce through the membranes.
That's its entire purpose in life. And here's what happens. She's surrounded by three... The egg is surrounded by three lines of defense.
Mm.
You can see in my mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
A fortress that has to be breached by the sperm before the egg will yield. Now, the first thing that happens is every woman has on her egg a thing called the cumulus. Cumulus, as in cumulus.
Accumulated.
As in cumulus nimba, as in,
right.
You know.
A cumulus means a pile of.
A pile of.
Mm.
It's a thick layer of shapeless cells that the egg has brought with it from the ovary. Now, why does it have this out there? Because you want to get impregnated by sperm that could make it through.
Right.
You don't want to make it an easy job.
Right.
You got to get the stronger of the sperm because that's going to help you survive. Okay, so now beneath the cumulus is another relatively thick, small layer called the zona. Now, I am sure many of you never thought you had a cumulus and a zona. But every woman has got this. It's the outer membrane of the egg itself. Under the zona is a narrow space that surrounds the final, most vulnerable barrier of the egg, which is called the vitelline membrane.
The vita what?
Vitelline. It's V-I-T-E-L-L-I-N-E. Maybe that's
vitelline.
The vitelline membrane. Sounds like the name of a movie. Now, using its head, the sperm punches its way through the cumulus cell, and then it reaches the zona, and then it sticks its head into the membrane with chemicals. This chemical attachment serves as an initial purchase, and the sperm again uses its head to cut a way through. This time, because the sperm has pounded its head into this thing, it gets a sharp, pointed spike on its head. And it exposes the tip of its head, and then the lashing tail provides the force to push the sperm forward. Finally, if this sperm is the first to get through the zona, cross the underlying space, and touch the vitelline membrane, it's engulfed by the egg in a welcoming embrace. Ah, you're home! Mm-hmm. I've been waiting for you. Sit down, have some pasta. It's a welcoming committee. Because it's not fighting it off. It's just saying, I wanted to know you could swim the moat to get to me.
Right.
After embracing one sperm, the egg passes a chemical message across its surface and within seconds become impenetrable. So one egg gets in there right away. It shuts the door.
One sperm.
One sperm gets in there. It shuts the door and it says, nobody else come home.
Right.
Nobody else is welcome in. I got the guy.
Yep.
If you're a human sperm, there is no prize for second place. It's only first place. The successful sperm sheds its membranes within the egg, releasing its genetic heart of DNA. This then travels to fuse with the similar heart of the egg. So the egg has a DNA, the sperm has a DNA. The fusion of the DNA from the sperm and the egg mixed together, and the genes from father and mother in equal proportions, a new person has been conceived with characteristics that are a subtle mixture of his both parents. That's the way it happens, friends.
It's
a movie.
Yes. It's fascinating to realize that these are long distances for the sperm to travel that long a distance. It's a journey like going, I don't know, from here to the other side of the world or even longer. So this is how it all begins.
One wonders where this quest spirit of humans comes from. One day I was driving down a beach road, and there were some kids with carrying surfboards. And I said, where are you going? And they said, oh, we're going to go to a surfing contest. And I said, where are you going? And they mentioned a beach that I knew was a good hour and a half away if you were walking. And they said, we've been traveling 4 hours. To get here by foot.
With the surfboards?
With surfboards, because their friend dropped them off in a town far away.
Uh-huh.
So they're walking along, and of course I was driving, so I gave them a lift. And they chase hurricanes. You know, whenever there's a hurricane, they want to get on the waves and run the waves. But I'm saying, okay, so what is this thing? What makes these people do this quest, a six-hour walk, to compete in the water with your surfboard, to be the champion surfer? It sounds so much like conception. It sounds so much like, and this is what your ancestors did in order for you to get here. This is what you did once before when you were just, you know, a tiny, tiny, tiny sperm. You did the very same thing. You walked 6 miles into the ocean, you know, to try to become the very best surfer.
Mm-hmm.
Because surfing is kind of like what the sperm do.
Yeah. And if you think of what has to... of the timing, how it has to all work out between the man and the woman seeing each other at first. And then what do they see, Armand? What does a couple have to see? What does the woman need to see in order for her to start thinking that perhaps she might allow this man to come closer? And what does he have to see in her? Because before we get to the sperm and the egg, there's a lot that has to happen.
Let's think about attraction for just a minute. Do men prefer blondes?
Well, all the statistics and all the studies and all of the questioning, Armand, say that yes, women, blonde women are indeed the best liked in a sexual sense.
The most attractive to men. Now, there we go. And right away, we're going to say stupid, stupid men. Right? Stupid men, blonde. So a woman dyes her hair blonde.
Well, most women who dye her hair, that's exactly how they dye it, blonde. When you look at which color of hair is the preferred one, when a woman decides to dye her hair, it's blonde.
Never heard of a blonde person who said, I dyed my hair brunette.
Very rare.
I've never seen that.
Very rare. No, brunette, never. Maybe sometimes they go from red. Blonde to red or black.
Green. Or green
yes,
or black.
Yes, or green or blue, but never brunette, no.
Okay, so let's talk about why this. Now, here we think this is just another stupid male thing. Why blonde? Why do they want blonde? What do you think?
Well, it seems that hair is a very important signal when it comes to fertility. Because the younger a person is in the eyes of a man, the younger a woman is, the blonder she is. Meaning that when babies are born, especially in the Caucasian race, but in other races as well, the hair of the baby is lighter than what it turns out to be later on. So the brain makes the association between blonde hair and youth.
Light hair, actually, as long as it's not white.
Right. No, when it gets to
light hair with melanin, with color.
Gray or white, that's associated with old age and infertility. But blonde hair is associated with fertility. So in the eyes of a man, a blonde woman is a woman who is fertile. And that's why that's why men appreciate that better than the brunette or the dark hair. Now the dark hair, brunette, black, is associated with maturity, with adulthood. So it's attractive, but not as much as blonde. Now when a man looks at a woman, what he looks for is youth, because the younger the woman is, the more fertile she is. So, and this is completely instinctive, it's completely below the conscious level. Of course, it's not true that men only like young women, men like all women, but the instinct will tell a man, this woman is younger, therefore she is more fertile than an older woman. Now, for women it's different, Armand, it's interesting. Do women like a blonde man over a dark-haired man?
No, it seems that the other side is what's the evidence.
Right.
The evidence is the dark-haired man seems to get more attraction than the blonde-haired
That's
man.
That's correct.
Why do you think that is?
Same reason, because the dark hair represents adulthood, represents maturity, and therefore represents strength and represents the capacity to provide for a family, represents being an adult and therefore being responsible for taking care of the eventual offspring. So women prefer dark hair and men prefer blondes.
Isn't that something?
That's amazing, because I always thought that was such a, you know, what are they called? Cliches and, you know, all of that. But it isn't.
Chauvinism and all that stuff.
It isn't.
Okay, now we're going to be back. We've got to take a look at this.
But because there are a lot of other things that signal fertility. So before the egg and the sperm get together,
we're going to have to come back to that. We're going to come back to that, which is attractive. We're going to take a short break, my friends. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We will be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Well, I thought we'd have a station ID there. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. That's right, it is 99.5 FM in New York City. Here's a little thing for you. Dear friend Brent Lewis, you're listening to his work. He's an amazing guy. I just wanted to play something that sounded like sperm chasing an egg. Armand DeMille here with you with Roberta Atti. We're talking about what turns people on besides music. You know, music does a lot. It must be jelly because jam don't shake like that. That's what Fats Waller said. You know?
Yes.
Guess where I'm going.
Well, we were talking about what causes a man and a woman to be attracted to one another way before the sperm can reach that egg. A lot of things have to be right.
Well, let's talk about males. And by the way, when we talk about men and women, we're talking about reproduction. Of course, we're not relating to the same-sex stuff, but it's certainly recognition of that as well. Let's talk about this for a second, Roberta. When most animals have a way of telling if the other one is a good partner. You know, certain birds build great nests. Mm-hmm. And you want to meet a guy with great nest. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Hey, fella, how's your nest? Well, let me show you my nest.
Mm-hmm.
Some people bring food. Right? Wasps love to be brought food wrapped up in a in a thing by another
one? Sure. Mating always requires that the two partners are willing to give to one another.
An appearance
is a way of giving.
Like, look at the peacock. How could you resist that peacock? Well, you know, some woman may look at that peacock and say, hey, it is just a small feather.
Mm.
You know, your eye on your peacock is too small. I want to have... Hold that laughter. No, I mean, you know, they do.
I understand.
Your mane, you know,
sure.
on the lion's mane may be too small.
Mm.
You know,
I don't think they think in terms of small or large.
But I think they do think in terms of small or large, don't they?
Impressive, maybe. Or maybe it smells a certain way. Or maybe it's the lion's whole behavior that counts.
Could be behavior, right?
You know, it depends on how a certain animal behaves. And
it's not how big your mane is, it's how you use it.
Exactly, Armand. That's what I was going to say. It's how you use your mane. But some bird, for instance, I don't know if you've seen them engage in these exquisite dances that go on for days.
The secretary birds are fantastic.
The secretary bird?
Yeah.
I didn't know about the secretary bird, but I knew. I know because I've seen them, documentaries of these birds that go through these elaborate dances, just exquisite. And they really have to convince that female, because usually it's the male that goes through the dancing and the showing and the plumage and all of that. It's the female that through his looks conveys to the female certain signals. And that's true also for humans. Although for humans...
But don't males also select females based on certain characteristics as well? Because feathers... plumage, other stuff, and smells is what we've always been able to depend on. But humans developed a different thing. What are they going to do if they're not going to have bigger wings? What are they going to do? What is the item? What is the thing?
Well, you see, the thing is that humans have a tremendously well-developed sense of vision. So for humans, the eyes have to be stimulated, and especially for human males, because human males being that they have to be good hunters, they have developed a very sensitive, keen eye sense, whereby the eye needs to be stimulated first by the female in certain ways in order for the male to be interested.
Well, let's go back. It's not just the male for the female. There is a thing called a flicker fusion threshold. Yes, my friends, you all have a flicker fusion threshold.
You most certainly do.
We all have a flicker fusion threshold.
Yes, we do.
FFT. SMD.
And that is the threshold at which the eye is able to perceive the flickering light, a light that goes on and off. If that goes at a certain speed, if the on and off, if it turns on and off at beyond a certain speed, you're no longer able to perceive when it turns off. It looks like it's always on.
Like a movie.
Exactly.
Like, remember when you used to have those flip cards and you flip the cards and they would look like a continuous movie? The flicker fusion threshold. SMYP. It's FFT. Flicker fusion threshold is a thing that is the ability to see things flickering.
Right. And it's better, it's more developed in males.
Because they're the hunters.
They're the hunters, than in females, because this is a capacity that's based on the... on the rod cells of the eye, and in the male of the human, the rods are better developed than in females, and that also gives better peripheral vision, and it gives usually a better sense of things moving in space, not just when you focus on that thing, but also with the peripheral vision, which means you don't have to have your eyes focused on something in order to see it. Now, males have a better peripheral vision than females.
And a better flicker vision.
And a better flicker threshold.
Flicker.
Which means that it's more sensitive. So now, look at...
So flicker is important. I know you hear me mentioning this an awful number of times, the flicker response. It's also called the jiggle response.
The jiggle, because it's not jam, it's jelly.
We're going right to that.
According to Fats Waller. Yeah. Well, because we're talking about fat people, let's call it what it is. Fat, the well maligned, the bad reputation fat, the thing that everybody hates, is what triggers the interest of a human male when he looks at the female, because her body parts that show fertility jiggle with fat. And I'm sure all of you now, as I say that, have an image of what I'm talking about. When you see a woman walk by, if you're a male, what do you notice? And the way in which the body, in which the fat is distributed in the body of a female causes it to jiggle in a certain way that for the eye of the male is particularly interesting. Now, first thing that happens, therefore, is the male focuses his eyes on the jiggling, on the flickering.
That which is jiggling is going to catch my eye. Little wonder that men like these topless clubs and,
exactly,
you know, these things that people go to,
right,
where they could watch the jiggle.
And again, that's not because men are, whatever the name is,
but stupid.
I wasn't going to say that. It's not because men are devious. It's because the brain of a male has evolved with that drive to look for the fertile female. Now, a woman does not menstruate. A young girl does not arrive at menstruation until she has a certain amount of fat in her body, because until she has that amount of fat reserves, she would not be able to go through the pregnancy safely, nor would she be able to lactate the baby. In fact, milk is made from the fat, from the reserves that a woman has accumulated through living. And if she does not have enough of that, nature says, no, we're not going to do it.
Wait, I thought milk was sweet blood.
It is, but I mean, you have to have a certain amount of fat to be converted into milk.
That's why women grow breasts get so large.
That's correct.
Because it's stored in the fat.
It's stored in the fat.
So
but the
it's
interesting
a fat
part,
breast, not a milk-filled breast. You know, a lot of people's image is it's filled with milk.
No, it's filled with fat.
It's filled with
although
fat.
When the woman is lactating, the breast will increase in size because, of course, it swells up with milk on top of the fat or underneath the fat. But here's what's interesting. In other species, land species, in other mammals, they also have accumulation of fat. But usually it's accumulated either within the muscle tissue or in and around the organs. None of the other land animals have the fat accumulated in the way that a woman, a human female, has. So the way in which the fat accumulates on the body of a woman is particularly shaped to move in a certain way that attracts the eye of the male, because that eye is used to hunting and it has a certain equilibrium between the rods and cones, and the rods are the ones that pick up the prey. And so hunting and sex, unfortunately, as we have said before, do go hand in hand, because the more meat I'm able to pick up, the more sex I'm going to get. That's the brain of a primitive hominid says that. But also the same rods are used for picking up a signal that a woman is fertile because she has that reserve of fat that jiggles as she walks
and
by.
And what parts of the body jiggle the most?
You tell me that.
No, you tell me.
I don't know. Well, the breasts, I'm assuming, and the buttocks.
Right, and the breasts and the buttocks.
Right, which are, of course, the parts of the body of a female that are most involved in both sexual mating behavior as well as reproductive behavior.
And this, when they jiggle, now, this is the moving, the jiggling, the fact that there is fat layers.
Should
that
we
move.
Be talking about these things?
Well, you know, I'm not...
I think this is all extremely educational and scientific.
Where
it's
else
just,
could you do this except on WBAR, you know?
That's what I'm
I know some people
object
to our talking about it, but, you know, it's...
I've had some people say to me, how can you speak about these issues so graphically and descriptively? Doesn't the audience get offended? And my impression is the opposite, that they are honored and they are grateful that we are willing to explain these things. Because also, for instance, for me, learning that fat accumulation is, that this is the purpose of it, makes me rethink the way I look at fat.
Yes, and if you think about it, you know, when people work at reducing their fat, what happens when you have no fat on your body? You have no menstruation.
Of course.
What do you mean, of course?
Well, of course, because
if half our audience, which is probably the men, don't know that.
If you lose your fat, and women bodybuilders, women athletes, runners sometimes do, because they go below a percentage of fat that causes the hormonal system to shift, whereby they can no longer, they're not supposed to conceive. The body says, I'm not allowing you to have a baby because you don't have enough fat to survive the pregnancy and to lactate and to give milk to this baby.
That may be a choice you might take. You know, you may go get some eggs frozen, put them in a bank, you know, go work out, reduce your body fat, choose not to have a baby in the earlier parts of your life. That's one choice if it's done consciously. But the fact that sometimes people don't appreciate the role of their bodies in their natural state is very important, because they get so frustrated trying to conceive.
And also, Armand, I think that all of the interfering that we do with the natural rhythm or concept of conception and fertility is kind of strange, and it seems to lead down a road that I'm not sure. I don't want to judge it, but I'm just questioning it. One thing that I find fascinating, do you know that most babies are born on the full moon? And most menstruation of women happens on the dark moon?
Let's talk about that. That's really fascinating.
Yes.
What's the dark moon and what's the full moon?
The dark moon is when the moon is completely invisible. And so the night is dark. There's no light at all. And it seems that that causes a withdrawal of the hormones from the woman's body that will precipitate a menstruation. Now, but think of it in terms of evolution. Back when there was no light, right? It was a lot safer for a woman to have a baby on the full moon because there was some light. And so since most babies are born at night, and that makes sense as well because of the whole, the fact that a lot of the predators would not be around and it's easier to hide. But with the moonlight, you have enough light that you can at least see where your baby is, you know, so I think it's fascinating.
There's something remarkable, again, you know, about people who look up at the moon and go, oh, what a beautiful feeling. Mm. A certain feeling you get of safety.
Sure.
You know, and maybe it relates. Maybe you're born under a full moon.
Well, most babies
most
are.
Most likely you are.
You're most babies are.
You're born under a full moon, and I wonder if hospitals know this.
I doubt it.
Where do you get the statistic, Roberta?
Well, this is from Dr. Schlein's book, Time, Sex, and Power. It's still from his book, which is How Women's Sexuality Shaped Human Evolution. And it talks about how most babies are born on the full moon. And also, Armand, we all know this, but we take a group of women, we put them together every day for a certain time. After a month or two, menstruation will occur for all of them at the same time of the month. That's another thing that comes from the past, when in a group of humans, of hominids, it was a lot better for women to menstruate all at the same time because it was safer for the tribe, and also because it synchronized the births of babies. If most babies are born at the same time of the month, which would happen as a consequence, that facilitates birth because it's a common event rather than just an individual event. So a lot of these things that happen with reproduction that seem random are not, and have evolved through years of figuring out what works best.
Roberta Ati, Armand DeMille, a woman has these fat deposits, which are now called the shape. And she tries to shape them, and she tries to keep them under control, but it is a sign of fertility.
Right.
It is, and and it's one of the signs. Now, Roberta, let's talk about pregnancy for a minute or two, okay? The woman becomes pregnant. Now she's lactating. Isn't there a lot of stuff to know about that?
I think, most importantly, we should say that if we left things to nature, a woman has a baby, and this baby is completely dependent on her milk for at least 3 years, Armand. For 3 years, the baby eats nothing but the mother's milk. Now, that means that, of course, that the baby has to stay with mother, that they have to sleep together, they have to share a bed, they have to be together all day long. In fact, in primitive cultures, what you will see is a mother with the baby always on her back, and the baby is most of the time asleep, very peacefully. None of this screaming and none of this despair that modern babies in our society seem to show. The baby is sleeping except for when it wakes up to feed. And also she's so in tune with this baby because he's always there. He or she is always there on her back that she knows, mother knows when the baby has to go to the bathroom. There's no need for diapers. Think of the mountains of diapers that end up in landfills and that are discarded every day by modern mothers. Well, none of that when the mother is so in tune with her baby that she can feel when he or she has to do number one or number two. So she removes the baby from her back, she puts it on the ground, allows the baby to do what it needs to do on the ground, and then she wipes it up and puts it back on her shoulders, and the baby goes back to sleep. Babies sleep most of the time, and that's what's best for their immune system, for their nervous system to grow for 3 years. Now,
but if you're doing 3 years, it must deplete. You know, you're a nutritionist. Your expertise is in helping people, in addition to being a smart person and helping people with a lot of things. One of the things you do the best is nutritional consultation. In these nutritional consultations, you have women who are pregnant, who may be breastfeeding. Do they have certain deficiencies that they go through automatically if they're breastfeeding?
Not automatically, Armand, although it can happen in modern women because most of us have been raised on a diet that's less than adequate. And so by the time we get to the age when we do have babies, our bodies may already have been deficient in certain vitamins and minerals and nutrients for a long time. So that needs to be addressed, and it's important to know what to take and what not to take in pregnancy, because in pregnancy, everything you take affects your baby, and you have to watch that you don't take things that could hurt it.
Give me an example of something you could take that could hurt a baby.
Herbs you have to watch for, because herbs are like drugs in a sense, although in a milder way, but they really alter the way that the endocrine system works. They could easily alter the hormonal flow from the pituitary or from the thyroid, causing an imbalance in the fetus that could be dangerous. Or, for instance, you could take too much vitamin A. Too much vitamin A could cause problems because it's stored in fat. And so you don't know if that's going to be in excess, what kind of damage it could cause for the baby's growing body. There are substances that, when you take them in excess, could cause the growth of the fetus to be impaired, to be slowed, to be accelerated. So it's always best to watch, to know what you're doing, although it's important for modern women to eat adequately and perhaps to take some supplements, because most of us are deficient as a result of the diet we've been fed. But going back to the baby, Armand, if a woman breastfed her baby for long enough, she would remain infertile during the time that she's lactating. So for 3 years, 4 years after having a baby, a woman would not conceive. And that puts a natural distance between births, so that makes a better mother health, a better baby health, a better child health, and it also resolves the problem of overpopulation. Let's think about it. We're 7 billion. And up until now in this series, we've been saying that everything is geared towards conception because that's the goal of the species. Now we're saying, yes, it is. But by breaking the rhythms, the bond, especially between mother and child, we have created a lot of pregnancy that happens too soon after the baby is born, and it gets to a point where we're overpopulated. There are too many births.
You know, it's just, I wish we could continue right now, but we can't. We have to be going. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're talking about human sexuality, the fifth in a series of programs that we've done, four of which are available. If you're interested in hearing the previous ones, you could call 212-757-4488. That's 212-757-4488. Be sure to tune in next Wednesday when we're going to be talking about communication, the evolution of communication, actually the birth of love. It's really an interesting thing. And how what that means to the survival of our species. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. Roberta, thanks again for...
Thank you, Armand.
We will be back with you tomorrow. I will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Armand@brainlink.com to send me an email. And the telephone number here again is 212-757-4488. Back with you tomorrow. Roberta, for health at AOL.com.
Degrees at 157. Good afternoon. If you are just joining us, you are tuned to us and supported commercial free community radio WBAI.